Welcome to the Rights Track Podcast, where we aim to get the hard facts about human rights challenges facing us today. I'm Todd Landman, and in today's episode, we're asking how statistics can be used to advance the cause of human rights. My guest is Patrick Ball, Director of Research at the Human Rights Data Analysis Group, a San Francisco-based non-governmental organization that applies rigorous science to the analysis of human rights violations around the world. Patrick is the world's leading statistician of human rights and has testified against Slobodan Milosevic, worked on numerous truth commissions around the world, such as in South Africa, El Salvador, Guatemala, Haiti, Peru, Sierra Leone, and East Timor. He helped identify the total number of people reported to have been killed in Syria between March 2011 and April 2013, and his statistical evidence has been used in the trial against General Efren Rios Montt for genocide and crimes against humanity in the early 1980s in Guatemala. Now, I met you several years ago. I think it was back in 2002. We were at an event in Brussels, and we were talking about measuring human rights and combining the statistics community with the human rights community, which was a kind of new agenda, new policy agenda at the time. And I met you at that event, listened to what you had to say about South Africa, and learned a lot from you about how you applied your thinking to the South African case. And then I met you again in Washington, where I was assessing the kind of different options for truth commissions in applying statistics to a history of past violations, and again, learned more about your approach and some of the developments that had taken place in between South Africa and the Peruvian work. So I guess my first question would be around, in general, how do you think statistics can be used to advance the cause of human rights?
I think that in general, when we have a question about the pattern of violence, if the violence is worse in the north or in the south, if it's worse against one ethnicity than against another, if we're worried about or concerned about the relative proportions between two perpetrators, those are the kinds of questions statistics can handle and can illuminate for us. Statistics is good at patterns. It's not as good at telling us about an individual case, a specific event that we might be worried about. For that, we need to turn to case investigation or ethnography to understand the context or some other discipline's illumination methods.
So it's about groups of cases. It's about, and when we talk about case, of course, there's a question of, you know, the person might be the case, but that whatever happens to a person can be broken down into smaller, what we call in social sciences, units of analysis. So you were very keen when you spoke to me over the years about making the violation the unit of analysis. So before we go any further, maybe you could tell us, what does that mean, making the unit of analysis the violation?
So when we talk about human rights, we often focus on a story, an event, something that happens, you know, the massacre, you know, at El Mozote in El Salvador in December of 1981, for example. And in that event, we have something like 1,000 or more than 1,000 victims. Each of those victims may have suffered many different kinds of violations, torture and theft or destruction of their property, and ultimately their arbitrary execution at the hands of the Salvadoran army. But there may have been other perpetrators as well. We may want to say not just that it was the Salvadoran army, but rather that it was the Batallón Atlacato, one of the immediate reaction battalions. There are some who say that American military advisors were present during this particular event, and they may want to attach the responsibility of those advisors to individual violations. So the notion of a violation turns on the connection among all of these three dimensions, the victim, the kind of violence that he or she suffered, and the perpetrator who committed it. And as you can see, there can be many perpetrators. Each victim may suffer many violations. It becomes a fairly complicated network of relationships. But when we want to count things, we need to disaggregate this event into those individual elements so that we're counting something in a reliable and repeatable way.
So you're disaggregating what you've called the grammar of a human rights event into its constituent parts, or the who did what to whom in that sense. And you might even add where and when and other factors, but it's ultimately about identifying this who did what to whom structure. And so it's possible for a single person to have experienced one or many violations by one or many people, and perhaps even in one or many locations at one or many different times, correct?
Yes, exactly. And in fact, to make it even more complicated, that person who we describe as experiencing these events as a victim may in other events play the role of the perpetrator. So we may have a person in one set of violations having suffered a violence against him or herself, but in another set of violations be the actor, be the perpetrator of those events. And this notion of crossing across that has been relevant in a number of different conflicts, notably in South Africa.
And so what's the problem of not doing it this way? So for people listening to this to think, well, why do you want to make the violation the basic unit of analysis? What happens if we don't do that? Why can't I just say there was a massacre and 35,000 people were killed?
If you're only interested in the killing, then by all means, only record the killings, and that will be a reasonable thing to do. But if you intend to understand, say, torture as well as killing, but you only record torture when there is no killing, and this is sometimes referred to as the most important violation recording approach, if you only record the most important violation, and in some cases people are killed without any preceding violence, in other cases people are tortured and then killed, and then in other cases people are tortured and then released, what will happen in the recording mechanism is that people who were tortured and then killed will be only recorded as killed, and people who were tortured and released will be recorded as tortured. So you'll miss a whole series of these torture events, and it will seem as though the only torture events are those which do not have a subsequent killing.
And what are the consequences of that?
The analysis that you derive from this recording method will hide all the events that ended in killing. So if there's a shift in strategy, as indeed there was in El Salvador at the end of 1983, away from killing and toward only detention and torture, it will seem as though torture has come out of nowhere. It will seem all of a sudden there will be lots and lots of torture events that were not visible before this transition. What happened at the end of 1983 is that this was a period of massive violence by the Salvadoran authorities, by the army, and by the paramilitary death squads that had been organized primarily within the army, as well as by the security forces, the Salvadoran security forces. And at this time, the campaign of terror between, say, about 1979 and 1983 was to capture people, torture them, and then execute them. But then Vice President George Herbert Walker Bush came to El Salvador at the end of 1983 and insisted in a meeting with the Supreme Command of the Army, he insisted that they stop killing people. I mean, I think from his point of view, the geopolitical point was that it was very hard to convince the American public to support the Salvadoran government in the presence of so much violence. So he demanded greater respect for human rights so that it would be an easier sell to the United States, to the Congress in particular, so that the U.S. could continue funding the Salvadoran government's conflict with the leftist guerrillas of the FMLN. And indeed, the Supreme Command agreed with President Bush, and they stopped killing people almost immediately. So the pattern of violence changed literally within a couple of weeks, at the very end of 1983. And the new strategy that they adopted was to capture people, torture them, and release them. So it was a campaign of breaking people rather than eliminating people.
Yeah, that's really interesting because, you know, there was an external sort of agent that changed the policy, and it parallels what happened in Chile as well, because the original Pinochet years, the sort of 1973 to 76, there was this overt disappearance, killing, exile pattern of violations. Then things became more institutionalized with an internal security directorate, and by the 1980s, it was much more mass roundups, arbitrary detention and torture, but not killing, and then letting people go again. And so that shift in strategy, if you will, whether it's externally determined or not, could be picked up by the approach that you have in trying to count violations.
Right. To follow up on the earlier concern, if you are only recording the most important violation, you'll miss the torture that occurs before in the regime during which torture and then execution. The torture is sort of one step along the way. So that what we need to do is be able to see torture as a continuous strategy through this period, which just has different results after the torture.
Right. So the thing that might change in the overall, shall we say, the time series trend would be that killing itself stops, but torture remained constant or it maybe even increased through that time. What are the sources you use for the statistical analysis? Because a lot of our people listening will wonder, well, what's the sort of primary data that you're collecting? What's the information source that allows you to do this kind of work?
So there are lots of different sources, but let's start with the most important and most frequent source, which is for the human rights community, the voices of the survivors and the victims. This is crucial. I mean, the human rights community is, in my opinion, fundamentally a movement of the survivors of mass violence. They are our first layer of people whom we're serving. So their voices, their testimonies, are the qualitative data from which we code the quantitative structure. So if people tell us a story about witnessing some violent event or experiencing it themselves, our job is to go through that story and to identify these units, these who did what to whom, these chunks of event, these that we will call violations. What we're looking for there is, of course, defined by the governing legal structure that we're working within, which is usually the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, It may also be local, domestic law in the jurisdiction we're working in that helps shape what we're looking for. But for the most part, we're looking for illegal detention, forced displacement, disappearance, killing, and torture. I mean, those are the kinds of things that we're usually looking for. And as we've gone through the years or the decades now, what we've found is that the only really reliably countable piece of that will be the killings. We talked about there are ways that we can code other violations. Detention and displacement are reasonably straightforward to code. Torture is very, very challenging, very complicated. Sexual assault may not be doable at all in a quantitative context. We've worked on it a lot of different ways, and it's not. I'm not sure that we actually are getting reliable estimates.
Okay, so you have a narrative statement. Somebody comes forward and tells you a story. A sort of someone who might be skeptical of this might say, well, what prevents them from telling you the wrong story or embellishing the story? And if people are afraid, they might not come forward. And so what about the people who never tell you their story? So there are people who come forward and tell you a story that's more or less true, and there are people who never come forward and tell you the story. How do you account for those difficulties in one of these processes of capturing these narrative statements?
Yeah, I mean, those are fundamentally the key issues. I think you've put your finger on it. On the first side, people will tell these stories in ways that we have to unpack. We have to figure out what's inside that story, right? That's what I was talking about in terms of the disaggregation process. Some of the elements of that story are going to be easy to misremember or easy to, if someone were so inclined, relatively easy to embellish. It's hard to document what happens in an interaction between perpetrators and the victim in the context where the victim's being tortured and then relating to us later what happened. It's hard for us to know, and it may be hard for the victim to remember clearly. So that's torture, again, something very, very hard to document quantitatively in a rigorous way. On the other hand, it may be, in fact, it is pretty straightforward to determine whether or not a person has been killed. So we're obviously not interviewing the victim, but if we're interviewing someone who's witnessed the death or found the body later, deaths in social contexts leave a hole in the social network. People know that person existed and they know that that person's no longer around. If people see that person walking around, clearly he or she has not been killed. This is something that tends to be pretty visible when people relate it. It's hard to fabricate large numbers of deaths. It may be easy to fabricate one or two, but it's pretty hard to fabricate enough to change a statistical pattern. So that's another reason that we tend to focus on deaths and violence.
What other details do you rely on them to remember?
Now, the person telling us the story may not know who the perpetrator was. They may not know how exactly the death occurred. You know, we rely on them to know that the death did occur by violence in the context of some conflict. This person was shot, or they were crushed by a building that was bombed, or something along those lines. And we rely on them to have a rough sense of when and where it occurred. Those are the key elements that we now depend on in our statistical reporting. So that's the question of how we deal with people who may have fabricated information. On the flip side, how do we deal with the possibility, or in fact the certainty, that many of the deaths in a conflict are not reported to us? And that's where statistical modeling of the undocumented deaths comes in, and we spend a lot of time doing that.
Okay, so let's unpack that a little bit. Let's use the example of Peru. In the end, you took close to 17,000 statements through the Truth Commission. You identified over 20,000 people uniquely as having died in that conflict who could be named, and yet the study then produced an estimation, a statistical estimation of many more deaths than that. The quoted figure in the newspapers was 69,280. They rarely quoted the range, as it were. It went from a lower range to an upper range, varying in some degree about 7,000 either side of that estimation of 69,280. So how do you get from 17,000 statements to 22,000 people known to almost 70,000 people estimated? How does that process work?
When I was at the South African Truth Commission, at one point, one of the commissioners, a woman named Mary Burton, asked me how many people died, how many people were killed in the various conflicts between the state and among the different challenging groups, including the ANC and the Inkatha Freedom Party. How many people were killed in those conflicts during apartheid? And I said, well, we have this many that have been reported to the commission. And she said, no. How many people have been killed in total, including the people who didn't come to the commission? And she was asking this just a few weeks before there was a giant surge of reporting of people came from Inkatha who had withheld their testimonies until that very last minute. And our concern was that we were going to underreport fairly drastically the victims from the Inkatha side, Inkatha members who had been killed by ANC activists during the the conflicts of the late 1980s and early 1990s. And I didn't have an answer for him. And that distressed me. I mean, we were at the time just coding data that was given to us, and so we didn't have a way to think about what we didn't have.
And what were you able to do about that?
So in subsequent projects, starting in Guatemala, just a few months later actually, working with a statistician in Washington named Fritz Schurin, I started thinking about a method called multiple systems estimation, or capture-recapture. And it's a method that relies on several independent observations of an event to figure out how many events you cannot observe. It's like many times people have seen in nature shows on television that the scientists will capture some animals and put tags on the animals. And then later they'll capture the animals again and they'll determine in the second round of captures how many animals that they've captured have tags from the first round of captures. And this turns out to be the heart of a method that we use now. The math that the ecologists are using to estimate animal populations is very similar to math, that's somewhat more complicated math, but logically related, that people use to correct human censuses, the censuses of populations for, you know, for political reasons that governments do, always undercount people, how many people have been missed. Well, we use a similar kind of math by doing a survey, a follow-up survey, and then figuring out how many people are on the survey and how many people were in the first census enumeration, just like the animals captured.
So what did that tell you?
What we realized is that when human rights projects document deaths in the past, this has a very similar kind of mathematical logic. So we have a project, as you raised in Peru, where the Truth Commission has conducted 17-odd thousand interviews and collected 17,000 stories. We also have projects conducted by the state that had offices dedicated to taking people's stories when the state had killed their relatives in various counterinsurgency campaigns. And there were also non-governmental organizations that took statements from people whose relatives had been killed by the state or by Sendero Luminoso insurgents. So there are multiple views of the universe of all the people killed in Peru. And what we were able to do, we're working with experts from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Peru, is to link all these databases, to connect them all together, to determine a bit more than the 22,000 that the commission had, more like 25,000 people were uniquely documented as having been killed in one or more of these various sources. And the logic we're going to use, like in the animal studies or in the census correction studies, is to say, okay, the larger the world is from which these projects have been drawn, then the less frequently the projects will have links with each other. And I sometimes think about this as the laws about temperature, volume, and pressure in a gas. When you have a gas and you push it together, you force it into a smaller volume, it gets hotter. And the reason it gets hotter is that all the molecules in the gas push against each other. They have less room, and so they knock against each other more frequently. And that temperature in a database context is like finding more duplicates. So As the database is larger and larger relative to the total number it might be, other databases will more frequently have the same, document the same deaths. They'll be compressed. It's in some sense like the temperature has gotten hotter.
So you'll get more duplication of reporting, and that'll tell you something about the overall size of what you're doing.
That's exactly right. And so more duplicates mean fewer undocumented deaths. And there's a bunch of other qualifications that have to be added to that, statistical assumptions that have to be investigated, and in for most of those assumptions, we have some way to address them statistically, but there's always a little bit that we can't address. One of the things we think about a great deal now is sort of what's the minimum probability that a given event might be observed before, below that probability, we just aren't going to be able to model it at all. There are some that are going to escape our attention. So this method we found through simulation and through other kinds of analysis, mathematical analysis, is always going to underestimate, but because we're always going to miss the people who just cannot be observed at all. They just... their families are resolutely hiding the event because they're, perhaps because they're afraid, perhaps because they've all been killed, perhaps because they've migrated away and can't tell you anything. So there's always some that escape the estimation. But the question we now have is, how low is that and how good a job can we do, even at those very low probability levels?
And so the final answer you get back to Peru of this estimation takes into account the overlapping structure of those different sources, the probabilities and the ratio of probabilities of being reported to one, two, or three of those sources. But in some sense, the intractability or the unobservability of what you're trying to do as well. So the difference between what people thought they knew and what you actually discovered and showed statistically then was in a way closing that gap in knowledge, if you will, but also raising questions about, wow, this was a really big problem that we didn't realize how big it was, because a lot of this was just completely unobservable.
That's right. And I think Peru has an especially fascinating story along those lines. One of the things we noticed looking across Peru is that the probability of reporting for Sendero Luminoso tended to be very low. That is, we had a very low ratio of killings committed by Sendero Luminoso to killings that appear in the databases. They're just, people didn't report killings by Sendero very much. And we saw that geographically, but the exception to that, the place where Sendero killings were well known, was Lima, was the capital area. And in reverse, we found enormous numbers of fairly well-documented killings by the Peruvian army, and substantial numbers in most places. But the place where they didn't kill very many people was, again, in Lima. So what happened is that people living in Lima, you know, reacting to what they saw in the reality of their world, is that Sendero Luminoso was rare killer. There weren't that many killings, but the dominant killer. You know, they were the ones who did everything. But when you look out into the world, you're like, hang on, both perpetrators committed quite a few violations. Sendero committed a lot more, but the intensity of the conflict was very much hidden from people in Lima. So we found, after when we reported this, and we published this finding as part of the Truth Commission report, that people were skeptical. They said, no, there can't possibly have been 69,000 deaths in this conflict because, you know, here in Lima, we only observed a handful, a few hundred in a huge city. So it can't possibly be that many. But what's interesting is that what this tells us, this kind of qualitative or subjective rejection of the map, tells us actually much more about the position of those critics than it does about the map. What it tells us is that the critics didn't have a representative view of what was going on in the conflict, because it was hard to travel to these war-torn regions in the mountains, and because, honestly, like in most countries in Latin America, there's a capital-based elite that is not especially well-connected to rural communities, particularly indigenous rural communities. They don't really know what's going on out there.
That raises a really big question around statistical thinking versus anecdotal thinking, right? And we see this in many public policy areas, but human rights is definitely an area that is also subject to that general difference. And so what you found were underlying statistical patterns, as you said at the beginning of your talk, about, you know, it's about patterns, about disproportional treatments of groups of people, differences between groups, etc. Not about, I look out my window and I don't see much violence, therefore you couldn't have possibly found 69,000 people.
Right. And that's a perfectly reasonable conclusion to draw. I mean, we all draw conclusions about the world based on our own personal experience of the world. And so statistics, in its pursuits of figuring out what we can't see, statistics often produces counterintuitive kinds of conclusions. And I think that's where statistics is at its best, is when it's illuminating things we did not expect or that we could not see. I think that the job of statistical reasoning in general, with particular application to human rights, is to help us check our preconceptions, to think about whether or not what we see is a reasonable representation of the world, or rather if there's some other world that may be hidden from our direct perception as a result of, you know, our geographic location, our social location, our logistical capacity to go out and see things, the trust of the people who are experiencing it relative to our social position, all those sorts of things combine to shape what it is we're able to see. I think in the best case, statistics help us transcend that.
I love that notion of statistics as the sort of counterintuitive illuminator. That's a nice, neat way of thinking about it. I wanted to ask you, one of your pieces of analysis in Guatemala showed that indigenous people in Guatemala during the 1982-83 period of rule by Rios Montt, in a particular region in the country, were 8 times more likely to have been targeted by the army than non-indigenous people. So in effect, it was this kind of ratio of kill rates, to put it bluntly. And when I see that, I'm, you know, intrigued by the result itself and the differences and the stark conclusions one can draw from that. But a lot of my legal students would say, and legal friends would say, but that doesn't prove intentionality. That doesn't prove anything. That just shows that, you know, people were more likely to be killed. So it raises this question. If statistics is the counterintuitive illuminator, can it also be the one that shows intentionality, or is that a step too far?
Well, that's a step vastly too far. When I hear lawyers complain, as your legal students did, I ask them, what is it that you think science does? Do you think that science replaces legal reasoning? That's just silly. Look, science is, in particular, statistical reasoning is one piece of a large argument. And if we're going to make an argument about genocide, that's one of the biggest arguments humankind can make about an action by a military or political leader. That's a huge argument. That's an argument that's going to take input from a lot of different disciplines linked together by really, really good reasoning. And statistics is just one paragraph among dozens of paragraphs. It is not a panacea. It is not a silver bullet. It is not a single piece of argument. It is one piece. Now, and when you're making a genocide argument, all of these pieces have to be present, and all of them have to be pointing in the same direction. It's a really big claim. So you have to have ethnography that suggests that the when the perpetrators committed this action, they were doing things that were consistent in an experiential way, that they were saying things, you know, that people were listening or witnessing them, heard the perpetrators saying things that are consistent with the claim that the perpetrators were trying to destroy a given community in whole or in part, as is required by genocide. You would also require analysis of the documentary evidence. What were the orders that the perpetrators received? You would also require all kinds of other information, probably from forensic scientists showing the kind of exceptional savagery of the violence, of the genocidal violence, as documented in the human remains. And then you would also need statistical results. And the statistical results show no more than a gross disproportionality in the relative risk of being killed by the perpetrators, by the alleged perpetrators. If the statistical finding is not present, if there is no or very little difference in the relative risk between the target group and other groups that may have also been killed by the perpetrators at the same time and in the same locations, then a statistician would say that this statistical evidence is inconsistent with the finding that there was genocide. But and I would question whether or not there was a genocide or whether there's not some other war crime at play here. But if there is a gross disproportion in the relative risks, as there was in Guatemala, as there was at Srebrenica, as there was in several other places, then we would find in the other direction that the statistical evidence is consistent with the hypothesis that genocide was committed. But let's be clear about the finding that's being made here. The finding that's being made is a consistency with the argument that genocide has been committed. It is not proof. And proof is a decision we make in legal contexts by judges or other finders of fact, not by a statistician, not by a forensic anthropologist, not by someone who studies satellite images, not by an ethnographer, but rather by someone who's putting together all the pieces of an argument and making a finding on top of the consistency of lots of different disciplines' positions. So there is no silver bullet here, and dismissing statistics because it's not a silver bullet not only misunderstands statistics, I believe it misunderstands all of argument.
So I think this is a really great point that you know this work is multidisciplinary. It requires multi methods. It requires many forms of evidence that are marshaled together to support an argument. And this notion of statistics being consistent with or not consistent with an argument being put forward is absolutely crucial. And so it doesn't say that you shouldn't be doing this work. You absolutely should be doing this work. But it is one part of a very larger puzzle and a larger piece of argument that's taking place. And all of that is really driven by a desire for accountability, a desire for knowing what happened under what conditions and who did what to whom, to the degree that we can be reasonably certain. But statistics itself, as you say, is not this silver bullet.
Not at all. There is no silver bullet. And looking for a silver bullet, as I said, I think misunderstands the structure of argument.
Yeah. So my final question then, I guess, is what are you working on currently? And are you still doing similar work that you did in these places we've talked about today? What areas of the world are you and the Human Rights Data Analysis Group working on?
Well, we're working hard on an analysis of killings in Syria. Syria is the biggest conflict we've ever worked on in terms of the total number of deaths, and perhaps more relevantly, in terms of the amount of available data. Syrian NGOs have been just breathtakingly committed and powerful and brave in the face of this long, long civil conflict and the brutality of this conflict. The NGOs have consistently produced what I think are quite reliable lists of casualties. And so we've been studying those lists and trying to do estimates, but because it's so big and because there turn out to be some interesting complexities in the data, we have not been able yet to publish an estimate. We're still working on it, and it's the centerpiece of our work right now, is this focus on Syrian casualty patterns. I'm very eager to finish it, but it's really, really hard.
Hugely complex. The scale, the volume, the perpetrators, the stakeholders. It's a huge undertaking that you're doing there. So I wish you the very, very best with that. Which brings me to just thank you for your time. You've made reference to this method of multiple systems estimation. One of our guests on a previous podcast, Kevin Bales, has used it to estimate the number of slaves in UK. For example, and There's a real interest in how we can marshal statistics for human rights work, but being very mindful of the cautious tale you tell, and this idea that there's no silver bullet, that this is, it complements other forms of evidence and allows us to build arguments to advance the cause of human rights. So on behalf of this episode of The Rights Track, thank you very much, Patrick Ball.
Thank you. Great to be here.
This episode of The Rights Track was presented by Todd Landman and produced by Chris Garrington of Research Podcasts. The podcast project is funded by the Nuffield Foundation, and you can find additional information and resources at www.rightstrack.org.